I'd like to welcome everyone and ask everyone to make sure you get a cup of coffee, although with today's discussion, I don't think you'll need the caffeine, and ask my speakers to join me up here. Thank you.
Good morning.
Well, I'd like to welcome everyone to today's Farm Foundation Forum. I know many of you in the room, but let me take the privilege and quite frankly, the opportunity to tell you that who I am. I may be a new face to many of you in regards to the Farm Foundation, but I'm Constance Coleman. Recently succeeded Neil Conklin as president and CEO for the Farm Foundation, just started the 1st of June. So this is a new opportunity for me. It's also kind of a fun opportunity for me because I am coming from corporate, but I also have academic, government, and ag organization background as well. So this will be a fun opportunity for me to join an organization that has a long history of talking about the policy issues that are affecting agriculture both here in the U.S. and globally. So I'm going to take that little opportunity and let you know that. But most importantly, I'd like to welcome both all of you who are here in the room at the National Press Club, but also our folks who have joined us by audiocast. And we want to thank the Farm Credit for the grant that allows us to have that audiocast and bring the messages from the specific speakers we have here today to a wider audience than can necessarily join us in the room. So thank you to Farm Credit. What I'd like to do is just kind of briefly introduce, I don't know, have all of you heard about a little vote that happened in the EU? I figure when the prime minister steps down and that's not the big news of the day, that something pretty significant happened with the Brexit vote on June 23rd. In that vote, the citizens of the UK called on their nation to withdraw from the European Union. And it's going to be a long process, about 2 years to negotiate the exit from the EU after they trigger that withdrawal, which is likely to happen sometime before year end. And the uncertainty that brings to both the UK and certainly to the international market in agriculture is significant. We have questions about subsidies that the UK farmers will receive, land prices, particularly in the UK, investments in the UK, and the impact, of course, that the currency fluctuation that we've already seen some evidence of will have on both the citizens of the UK, but also those of us who do business with that region of the country, of the world. Of course, closer to home here in the US, we're asking questions about what does this mean for TTIP negotiations? What does this mean for our trade with both the UK and the EU? And how much does that affect US farmers and producers and businesses here? Well, fortunately, we have an excellent panel to help us ferret out, if not all of the answers, maybe some of the questions and things that we need to keep an eye on. What we'd like to do is have a quick presentation by each of these three panelists, and then we'll open it up. Most of the time, we will be dedicated to some questions and answers from both the folks here in the room and also on audiocast. And we'll go until 11 o'clock or till your questions run out, whichever comes first. But let me first jump right into telling you a little bit about the panelists that we have here with us today. Speaking first will be Benno van der Laan. He's with Greenhouse Communications and has designed and executed numerous advocacy campaigns across several different countries and is experienced in coordinating and directing multinational teams of consultants. He's actually from Netherlands, but speaks five different languages, as we talked about this morning. So I've asked him to stick to English for today's seminar. He formerly worked for the European Commission in Brussels, so he has an on-the-ground extensive knowledge of that legislative and regulatory process. So I think he's uniquely qualified to speak directly to some of those types of questions we may have here today. He moved to Washington, D.C. in 2001 and has assisted several U.S. companies and trade associations in pursuing their interest in Europe and elsewhere. So he's worked on behalf of many of the U.S. farmer organizations and has helped them with some of the different European policies that affect agricultural commodities. So thank you, Benno, for joining us. I'm also going to take the opportunity to introduce you to our other two speakers, so as we get started, we can go from one conversation to the next. John Dardis will be speaking to you second. John is the Senior Vice President for U.S. Corporate Affairs with Glanbia. He oversees Glanbia's policy positions, government affairs, reputation, and issue management, working with a huge range of businesses that are part of this company's growing footprint in the United States. They are involved in cheese. I thought they were like a milk company, but it's amazing that the number of different products, cheese, whey, ingredients, customized solutions, the very fastly growing sports nutrition operation is something that they also are involved in. John also served previously as Ireland's first Secretary for Agriculture, so many of you may know him from his time here in Washington. First Secretary for Agricultural, Food, and Marine at the Irish Embassy, where he did an excellent job managing Irish agri-food trade interests, including the involvement in the TTIP negotiations. So I think John's conversation on the TTIP will also be very, very interesting. Now, Mike Dwyer is the chief economist for the U.S. Grains Council. And for those of you at FAS here in the room, he's also a familiar face. But now at the U.S. Grains Council, which of course is a nonprofit organization promoting the use of U.S. barley, corn, and sorghum and related products, he provides trade, marketing, and policy analysis of developments in global supply and demand for feed grains and products. He also helps the U.S. Grains Council staff and its members stay ahead of the curve and understanding the developments in the global market, and develops and maintains information on changing market conditions that will benefit the Council's overseas contacts. As I mentioned, prior to joining the U.S. Grains Council, he spent 35 years at the Foreign Agricultural Service as a chief economist and director of global policy analysis. So I'd like to, he's also an Ohio State graduate, and I only mention that because it is one of the finest academic institutions in the country. So, oh wait, yes, I am also. Okay. That's right. So after the presentations, we'll open it for Q&A, but for now I'd like to ask Benno to come forward and share his thoughts with us.
Thank you very much, Constance. Good morning, everyone. Okay, so I'll do it, yeah. So we thought it would be a good idea to start off this morning by providing some general comments on Brexit, what are some of the next steps, and what is the context in which this is happening. So I will make a few comments about the EU, because you need to know what that is before you can talk about the impact of the UK leaving it. So with that, I'll start with this map of the EU. The countries in dark blue are the existing 28 countries. There are five official new candidates that have applied for EU membership, and with some negotiations for their accession has already started. And there are two countries, Kosovo and Bosnia, that are also aspiring to be EU members. So even with the UK leaving, it is likely that the number of countries in the EU will expand, not in the near future, but in several years from now. Most of these countries are small, except for Turkey, which has more than 80 million people. But the negotiations with that country, as you can imagine, are very difficult. And I think it's an open question as to whether they will actually join the EU or not at some point. One other comment, this of course does not depict the countries that are part of the Eurozone. There are 19 EU countries that are part of the Eurozone, and the UK of course is not one of them. So this is an overview of some of the key facts and considerations when you look at the EU. Of course, it's a large market. It will continue to be so even with the UK's departure. But one of the main achievements of the EU was the creation of the internal market, where goods, services, people, and capital can move freely without any obstacles. And of course, the free movement of people was one of the main factors that was discussed during the UK referendum campaigns. The EU is also unique in that the member states have voluntarily handed over sovereignty in many policy areas. So we now have a very large body of EU legislation that supersedes whatever the member states themselves can do at the national level. So there are many rules and regulations that affect the food and feed markets and that affect the sustainability of operations. The problem often for US and other exporters to the EU is that very often these EU rules add costs or create market obstacles. So very briefly, a few comments on the main EU decision-making body. So I will not bore you with a long explanation. We could spend the whole morning talking about this. But for today's purpose, the European Commission in Brussels is the institution that really drives EU policy and legislation. It is the only body that has the power to initiate new laws in the EU. It is also responsible for monitoring and supervising the way that individual member states implement EU law in their own countries. And the Commission is the institution that negotiates trade deals with third countries, such as TTIP, for example. The Commission receives a mandate from all 28 countries and then goes ahead with these negotiations. Then the European Parliament is the only directly elected body in the EU. All citizens of the EU are able to vote for their members of the European Parliament, the MEPs. There are 751 of them. They have a mandate of 5 years. I think it is fair to say that when it comes to their voting behavior, the Parliament tends to be left-leaning and green, certainly if you look at it from a US perspective. But it is a very important institution. It has the power to amend and veto any proposals for new EU legislation. And in that sense, the Parliament itself has as much power as the 28 governments that are part of the EU combined. So that is the Council of Ministers, which represents the governments of the 28 members of the EU. They, like the Parliament, the Council has the power to amend and veto EU legislation. They vote by qualified majority. So depending on the size of the country, they have influence on the way legislation is adopted, and very often individual member states are outvoted in that process. So that was an important factor of the way the EU has been adopting legislation. So moving back to Brexit, so I'm sure you'll all have heard that today there'll be a new Prime Minister, Mrs. May, and Earlier this week, she said that Brexit means Brexit. So although she herself was campaigning for the UK to remain in the EU, she is now in charge of overseeing the process of the UK leaving. Not a very comfortable position to be in, no doubt. But one of her first decisions, or most important decisions, is when to invoke Article 50 of the EU Treaty, which would officially start the process of the UK withdrawing from the EU. she hasn't been very precise on when this may happen. The European Commission and some of the other member states would like Britain to get on with it in order to create some, or at least remove one of the uncertainties that that we're currently facing. One of the key questions that we will have to look at is what kind of deal will the EU and the UK be able to negotiate after the withdrawal process has been completed? And I'll come back to that in a minute. The UK also will have to negotiate its own trade arrangements with third countries outside the EU. How is it going to do that? The EU has more than 50 preferential trade arrangements with third countries. I've read reports where the UK government has announced it is going to have to hire 300 new trade negotiators, because for decades these negotiations have been carried out by the European Commission and not by the UK government. So there will be challenges when it comes to resources as well. I've put Scotland on here as well. There are voices in Scotland that are calling for a second referendum on independence from the UK. I'm not an expert in this field, but I think there is some uncertainty as to whether that will happen, and if so, when it will happen. But the fact is that more than 60% of Scottish voters wanted to remain in the EU, so they're not happy with what was happening. So going back to the future relationship between the EU and the UK, for the UK it is very important because 44% of its exports go to other EU countries. Now, what are the options for the future? Will the UK be able and interested in becoming a country like Norway, which as part of the European Economic Area is able to, has defined its relationship with the EU? In the case of Norway, that means it has to comply with EU law. It contributes about 600 million euros to the EU budget every year. But it does have the free freedom, so free movement of goods, services, people, and capital. The question is this something that the UK government will want to go for? Because one of the key issues in the referendum was the concern about immigration and therefore the free movement of persons. So if they pursue a status like Norway, they would have to accept the free movement of people as well. So that might not be a fully desirable option. The other option would be some kind of a bilateral trade arrangement between the EU and the UK, but that has the disadvantage of bringing with it all kinds of uncertainties. You know, how would that deal look like? Would there be tariffs? Would there be quota? Would there be an alignment of legislation between the EU and the UK? Would there be mutual recognition? A lot of uncertainty there. And one of the key questions is how accommodating are the other EU countries going to be in negotiations with the UK for a new arrangement? As you may be aware, there has been a growing anti-EU sentiment in several EU countries, and those countries will surely not be keen on being seen to be giving up too much to the UK in those negotiations. Just a side note on that, there has been a survey among several countries among citizens as to how they see the EU today in the light of the Brexit vote. And it turns out that more people are now in favor of the EU. They see the advantages of the EU, or rather, they have seen the negative impact of the UK leaving. Stock market down, pound sterling down. So I think a lot of people in other countries are having second thoughts and maybe look at it in a different way. There are also elections in 2017 in some major EU countries, in Germany in April, in France in April, in September in Germany, and also in the Netherlands. So that will play a factor in how the negotiations will go. On the other hand, the UK is also an important market for the other EU countries. So member states will have to balance that. So what does Brexit mean for EU decision-making and its policies? Well, first off the bat, before the withdrawal process has been completed, the UK will remain a full member of the EU. Having said that, there are already signs that the UK is losing influence in the EU today. Jonathan Hill, who was the UK Commissioner for Financial Services, resigned his post. That was one of the most important posts in the European Commission. There will be another UK Commissioner. Julian King has been nominated, but he will likely get a much less important portfolio. Another example is that it is unlikely that the UK will assume the rotating presidency of the Council of Ministers, which it was scheduled to take on in the second half of 2017. It will likely lose that. And there are already examples of UK members of the European Parliament giving up important roles in the European Parliament. For example, Ian Duncan, MEP, resigned from the rapporteurship on an important piece of legislation in the EU. So that is already happening. After the withdrawal process has been completed, the EU will surely miss the UK voice and the UK votes when it comes to developing new EU legislation. Traditionally, the UK has been one of those countries that votes in favor for free markets, for new technology, for science-based decision-making. Many other countries in the EU have a different approach. So we will certainly lose that. In the Council of Ministers, the UK represents about 12.6% of the votes. So that is significant, if potentially not decisive. In the European Parliament, the UK has 73 members of the European Parliament. They will go. And in several political groups, the UK MEPs have a very good reputation and have been very active members in the Parliament. So that will be surely missed. If we take two examples in the area of agriculture, one is the approval of new biotech products for imports in the EU. The EU needs imports because it's deficient in protein for its livestock. But for every new biotech approval, there is a scientific assessment, and then there is a political process to approve those products. And that involves a vote in the Council, in an expert committee of the Council of Ministers, which votes by qualified majority. Now, for every product that has been approved in the last 25 years, the Council never achieved the necessary qualified majority. There was always a block in favor, against, and abstaining. The UK has always been in the pro-biotech camp, so we will lose that vote. Now, it's unlikely that the UK leaving will tip the balance. It's probable that the anti-biotech camp will not be able to muster the necessary votes to reject new proposals. But there may be intangible impacts as well. Those other EU members that tend to be in favor of biotech tend to be smaller countries, and they will miss their big ally in the UK. And it's hard to calculate what that means in practice. Just to summarize on this point, the UK will be missed, but there will likely not be a qualified majority against, and that means that the European Commission will continue to be responsible for approving these biotech products, as it has been doing with great delay, but it has been doing so for the last few years. Another dossier that I could mention is that of crop protection products. There has been a tendency in the EU the last 5 years to base its decisions on authorization of new active substances or the renewal of authorizations on the basis of hazard, an intrinsic hazard of the substance, instead of looking at the risk of people being exposed. As a result, the number of active substances on the EU market has gone down. Maximum residue limits are being reduced. And this is of concern, of course, to European farmers, but potentially also for US exporters, because there is pressure in the EU, certainly coming from the European Farmers Union, that when a maximum residue limit is reduced, the same should happen with respect to the import tolerances in imported products. And there is a concern that the European Commission wants to move to a system where if a substance in the EU loses its authorization, that the import tolerance for that substance goes down to a default value of 0.01 milligrams per kilo. And that could become a problem for some US crops that are exported to the EU. So I won't even go into the discussion on endocrine disruptors. It just adds to what I've just said. And certainly the UK voice will be missed in those discussions as well. So finally, TTIP. I think it is fair to say that there has been little progress and that there remain serious obstacles in agriculture and food, in addition to other areas. Part of the problem is that several NGOs in the EU have been very effective in campaigning against TTIP as being a Trojan horse for importing levels of protection that are currently present in the US. They have really brought home that narrative, and many countries in the EU are struggling with that. So the stated goal by both US and European negotiators of trying to get a deal done before the US elections is probably unrealistic, but there is a 14th round of negotiations this week taking place in Brussels. So we'll see what the results are. Just one additional point. The EU and Canada have reached an agreement on a trade deal there. And the CETA deal has often been held up as a potential template for TTIP. Now, what has happened there is that the Commission has put forward a proposal for the ratification process of CETA. And originally, the Commission had wanted to have an EU-level vote in the Council of Ministers and in the European Parliament. But what it has decided last week is that in addition to those approvals, every national parliament in the EU will have to approve this deal. So that's 28 national parliaments plus several regional parliaments in some countries. That, of course, will make the whole ratification process more lengthy and slightly unpredictable, because if one national parliament says no, then CETA cannot enter into force. So maybe That is not an exactly, and apparently this decision by the Commission was taken because some member states have been saying, in the light of Brexit, the Brexit referendum, we don't want the perception to continue in some among citizens that these decisions are taken by bureaucrats in Brussels. And this was the reason why those member states insisted on a vote in their own national parliaments. So that may be a taste of things to come when it comes to trade deals in the future.
Thank you, Benno. That last point is extremely interesting, the immediate impact of that vote. As I invite our next speaker to come forward, John Dardis, I also want to just, for those of you who are participating via audio cast, for those of you who are not in the room, please feel free to begin sending any questions that you may have in, and we will compile those and staff will present those during our Q&A session. So, John?
Morning. Good morning. Is anybody out there? I have a right to be cranky. You don't. I have to stand up here. Thank you, Constance, and congratulations on the new position. And thank you, Benno, for explaining the EU, so I don't have to. Wanted to start off with sort of a personal reflection, if I could, and maybe Constance, if you could keep an eye on the time, because I'll keep waffling for the day. That's perfectly fine. You might tell from my Illinois accent, there's a slight hint of Irishness behind 6 years of living in the US. It's barely detectable, but it's there. So this is quite personal to me as well, as a business interest. I have a farm back in Ireland, which I've tried to sell to at every event I've spoken in the US for 6 years and failed. I'm not going to do that today. But some of what I'll say is also going to be from a farmer's perspective, because this is quite a shockwave if you're an Irish producer. It's more than that if you're a UK producer. I want to start off with telling you a little bit about Glanbia. Anybody, who here have heard of Glanbia? And my successor, Dale Crammond, is here from the Irish Embassy. Dale, you don't need to put your hand up because I'd be very worried. And Jessica from the Irish Embassy. But who else has heard of Glanbia? Okay. So I need to subliminally message on my slides, and that's why Glanbia is all over these things. It wasn't Mary's fault. But let me tell you a little bit about Glanbia first, because I want to set that context as to why this means something to us. Then talk about some of the immediate tremors that we're seeing in the market. And if I have time, maybe talk a little bit about UK agriculture and some reflections on that. Glanbia, we're a global nutrition company, 5 billion market capitalization. We have 6,000 people working for us around the world. We're in about 32 countries operating. We started off as a cooperative, a dairy cooperative in Ireland, and there's a whole lot of tangents I could chase here, but we eventually invested in the US when we became a public limited company, partly because of limitations through milk quotas in Europe. If we wanted to expand, we had to look to different markets. It's a point I might come back to, but as a global nutrition company, our mindset has become very open, if you like, not insular. And I think that's the first nugget I'd sow in your mind about Brexit. Being insular is not good. It's not good for people personally, and it's not good for an economy. The way our business breaks down, as Constance said, we do everything from what leaves the cow through to what goes into elite performance athletes. We do ancient grains out of South Dakota. We are the biggest sports nutrition brand company in the world. Any bodybuilders here? Any sports nutrition fans? Optimum?
No, you a bodybuilder?
No.
Okay, we'll work on that in Illinois. But we have the big brands in the world. So again, that's an interesting aspect on what we might talk about later on. I just wanted to boast a little bit. We do about 6 billion liters of milk we process. We're the number one American-style cheese manufacturer in the US, so a vast majority of our business is US-based, and bear that in mind for the discussion on Brexit too. But we're the number one whey provider, and you can see why we got into sports nutrition. Just to go back to that insular thinking, if you want to go anywhere in life, you kind of have to have a vision of where you want to go, as opposed to jumping around every day, maybe tweeting out some rhetoric that you don't mean, for example. We have a pretty focused ambition of what we want to be as a global nutrition company, and I would highlight trust as a key word in what we're saying there. And again, to be that, you've got to open your mind beyond the borders of where you now operate. We work in a world that is connected like never before. Our products move all over the place. And that's exciting, but anything that blocks that is a problem for us and a problem for our investors and a problem for everyone in this room. So, Brexit happened, 23rd of June?
23rd.
Yeah. I woke up, as most of you did, and read and thought, no, there's something wrong with Twitter today. That just couldn't have happened. It happened. I think the bottom line is nobody knows what's going to happen here. And that goes right the way to the top of the food chain, never mind Glanbia. The first tremor that hit on day one was the currency shock. Now, the strength of the sterling, this is not a new issue, as you can see on the chart. Sterling has been fluctuating, the dollar, the euro, everybody's fluctuating in the last few years. But a 16% hit on day one in the value of sterling is a pretty serious hit. It has recovered to a degree since, but think of it again with my former Irish hat on, what that means with the volume of trade between particularly Ireland and the UK, what that means on a day-to-day basis. Now, there are ways of managing this, which I'll cover on Tremor 2, and we in Glanbia like to think we have particularly strong risk management tools. So, Tremor 2 is the world we inhabit as a global trading company that any of you selling product overseas inhabit. Mike, you'll be dealing with the grains in a few minutes. And that is the world of volatility. Going back 10, 15 years ago on the Common Ag Policy, or even on the Farm Bill in the US, you had quite an insular mindset. A protected mindset. In Europe, you could trade within the community and be successful. Through decoupling payments in the EU, through breaking the link to production, through opening up borders, the world we now inhabit is become incredibly volatile. And to manage that, you've got to have the right risk management tools. We offer a whole range of different tools to our producers in Ireland, to our producers in the US. If you look at the European context, we're living in a post-quota world. Without risk management tools, you don't survive a post-quota world, okay? So whilst Tremor 2 and Tremor 1 are linked, there are ways of dealing with them right now. The concern is when Article 50 is triggered and the two-year clock starts to count, you're in a whole new world for risk management if the UK is a significant trading partner for you. I'd add it into the mix of Russia, the embargo. I'd add it into the mix of decreased Chinese demand, of currency, of whether these things just keep hitting, can you survive or not? Tremor number three links with what Benno was talking about, and again, coming back to my personal hat, I suppose. For us as Glanbia, about 3% of our wholly owned revenue is UK business. Okay, so I'm not talking on behalf of Irish agriculture. I'm talking on behalf of Glanbia, a global nutrition company, where really that trading impact is not that great. But as I've said, the volatility and uncertainty is an issue for anybody investing anywhere. This piece is the real worry. UK leadership. The UK went through referendum. And by the way, referenda in the EU are not that uncommon, as anybody that's lived in an EU member state will know. They generally don't follow the trend of political voting. They generally do capture a protest vote, as we've just seen. But we've lost the PM in the UK, the Prime Minister, with a new PM, Theresa May, as Benno said, installed today. We lost the two main protagonists on the Brexit side. That's a huge flux in leadership. And I think everybody in this room will agree that leadership is kind of important in the world we inhabit today. What happens to the EU movement, as Benno has gone to? Again, when you live in the US, you sometimes forget the bigger picture of Europe. I certainly do. I get stuck in the world of Glanbia and agri-food trade, and I forget that there is a much bigger consequence here. The European movement has brought peace to places that didn't have peace and democracy for quite some time. I can talk about my own island, where it has made a massive difference to Northern Ireland. What happens to that process? What happens to Scotland if they go after an independence vote again? So this is becoming quite emotional for me, because I am an Anglophile. And the knock-on effect for the UK movement is quite scary. The single market Benno has referred to. The fundamental thing in the single market is the free movement of people when you link it to Brexit. And Brexit is saying, we don't want that. So if they don't want that, and we can talk about it in the discussion, how do you fix that in a post-Brexit trade agreement, be it an EEAS, be it whatever mode you look at? And the last thing I'd mention in the political world is the ramifications for what's happening here. Can we read the tea leaves on a Brexit vote, a protest vote, and maybe look at what could happen in the US in November? And if you're an investing company around the world, all of this is bad news, all of this is uncertainty. Take, for example, our investments. Last January, we announced that we will expand our Southwest Cheese plant, which is a joint venture in New Mexico. It's the largest American-style cheese plant in the world. If something was to change tomorrow in New Mexico, would you go ahead with that investment or would you hold off? So apply that to whatever company is dealing in our sector or whatever sector. That uncertainty means you're going to hold on your decisions to invest. And I'm not quite sure people get that. You know, we talk a lot about, and Farm Foundation and everybody I've met in DC, we talk about people don't understand agriculture. You know, how do we make them understand what we do? Should we give them a good punch or should we talk to them or what should we do? Clearly with Brexit, people don't really understand anything about what's going on in the world. People don't understand how a trade deal works. People don't understand how EU regulations affect every single part of your day if you live in the community, affect every single part of how we move product as Glanbia out of or into Europe. The UK, maybe I'll, how am I doing on time? Because, okay, there's three more points I'd like to make. First of all, I talked about the bigger picture, because again, we'll go into the pigeonhole of our world. 3/4 of foreign investors cite access to the EU as the reason they invest in the UK. Now, if that doesn't knock you off your seat and make you worried as a UK citizen, I'm not quite sure what would. It is the number one country for inward foreign direct investment into the European Union. Why? Because you have that free movement of goods, free movement of people, a common market, a single market that lets you access wherever you want to go. I think, Benno, you mentioned services earlier on as one of the freedoms as well. 80% of the UK GDP is services. It is the entry point into the EU for services. They had a commissioner for services. You extract all that from the fabric of the European Union. What happens? I don't know. Nobody knows. Here's an interesting one. I kind of put this up a little bit mischievously. UK is the second least restrictive regulatory regime after number one being Netherlands. So sometimes when you're listening to some of the rhetoric about the EU, just remember who's one and two in the world on the lack of regulatory restrictions for doing business. It's an important market for the EU at 8%, but vice versa, with 44%, as Benno said, of UK exports going to the EU. It's a massively important market for our UK friends. The agri-food world, and I'm not going to keep going through slides, Constance, I'm going to finish with 2 points. What does the UK export and import? Fruit and veg is the big import into the UK, coming from Holland, but coming from all over the world as well. Beverages, as with the island I come from, whiskey, amongst other things, is huge. And when you dig out where UK products go to in the world, really it's the whiskey that goes beyond the borders of the EU. Other than that, most of it is traveling within the EU. So again, if you tune into some of the BBC commentary, I don't know how many of you listen to podcasts. It's my fault in life is listening to agri-food podcasts and filling my brain with stuff that nobody wants to understand or listen to. But you take out drinks in this, and some people will say to you, yeah, but this opens up the whole third country element for the UK. Where? Who's going to buy British beef? And how do you build that market without the machinery that is the Commission to do the negotiating for you? I want to turn briefly, finally, to the farming element of it. Common agricultural policy. Benno, why didn't you cover the common agricultural policy? Common agricultural policy was born out of the Second World War. Now, the irony of Brexit was it coincided with the week of the Battle of the Somme commemorations, 100 years since the Battle of the Somme, followed by World War II. Devastation in the European, in Europe, devastation around the world. CAP was born out of that misery of having nothing, no food, devastation. It became hugely successful because we switched from that to having mountains of food. And then, believe it or not, despite the huge machinery that's involved, it has evolved since to become decoupled, to support an environmentally sustainable agriculture, which is really sounds great, but to me, support rural communities. There are 12 million farmers in the EU on half the land base that the US has. I really don't want to see that change. That's personally something very important, but it's also important to your supply chain. Up to 50% of a UK's farmer's income is coming from the Common Ag policy. Now, you can respond to that to say, yeah, but the UK is a net contributor to the Common Ag policy. 87% of a Northern Ireland farmer's income is coming from European support. A number of those voted to leave. I have a slide here that shows you the demographics of who voted. It's hard to see it there. But the orange is Brexit, the blue is Remain. Rural communities voting to leave. If you look at the percentage breakdown of who voted to leave, elderly, 64% of people over 65 said leave. These are people who've experienced the European Union for a long time, and yet something's not working for them. And lesser educated, 70% without a GCSE as their final high school exams, voted to leave. Again, a message for what's going to happen here in November. People are angry and people are disillusioned. How do you fix that? I don't know. Just returning to the rural economy and farmers, if you look at Ireland as an example, agriculture is big business for Ireland. Agriculture is big business for Denmark, for Germany, for France, for the Netherlands, for a lot of European member states. But looking at Ireland specifically, during the worst part of the recession, the one sector that performed for Ireland was the agri-food sector, increasing exports. Dale, you can correct me, but I'm thinking about 11 million euros worth of, a billion euros worth of exports from Ireland. That's big business. Compared with the UK, which, if I'm not mistaken, is about 18 billion sterling exports, much bigger landmass. Okay? So think about this. If you're negotiating your exit strategy, and those discussions have started in the UK, Where does Ag and Food fit into your priority list? I can tell you if it was Ireland, it's going to be high up the food chain, because politically there's strong support. With the UK, I don't know. There's going to be an awful lot of elbowing going on. But if I was a producer in the UK right now, I would be very worried about how that resonates with leadership. Constance, I'm going to stop there and let our discussions continue. Just to summarize it all, we don't know. Nobody knows what's going to happen. The shock and uncertainty is a problem for us in doing our everyday business. For farmers, it's a real worry. And let's see how it plays out in the coming 2 years, if it plays out.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Thank you, John. Very interesting insights, and I think probably fodder for a lot of questions from the audience. I'd like to invite Mike Dwyer to come to the podium and share his perspective. Mike?
Morning, everybody. So, Constance knows me from a different job that we both had. I used to work for USDA for about 35 years, and one of the things that they had me do while I was at USDA is monitor the impacts of a series of major global events, and this would probably qualify, but frankly, you know, I guess I was brought in to talk about the economic impacts of this event. I'm not going to touch at all on the political side of things. I will tell you this, this may surprise you, but there are so many things that keep me awake at night that are way above Brexit. I think this will be a ripple. It will barely make a dent in the global food system. We're talking about Europe right now, and I'm not saying there won't be some fallout in Europe. I'm saying when you diffuse that across a huge global food system, I don't think this in and of itself will be that big a deal, with one major caveat, that assumes no contagion. In other words, if what happened in Britain starts to happen in France or Denmark or some of the other member states, I'll reserve judgment, that could be a lot worse. But you know, let me just say this, the main transmission belt for any effect on the global food system will come from what effect Brexit will have on global currencies, and I'm talking beyond 1 week. You have to remember, the night before the vote, it was conventional wisdom that they were going to remain in the EU. And so assets were priced around the world for that outcome. Well, everybody woke up the next day and that wasn't the outcome. So all that chaos that you saw in global equity markets, bond markets, commodity markets, foreign exchange markets, was the repricing of assets for an unexpected outcome. I do not expect to see this level of chaos continue very long at all. This is based on my own past experience following these sort of things. For example, Deutsche Bank, their chief economist, came out after the event and said, for Britain, this is bad news. They were expecting 2.1% economic growth in Britain prior to the vote. Now they expect 0.9. In the EU itself, they were expecting 1.5, now 1.1. I mean, European growth was anemic to start with. It's a little more anemic now, but not exactly falling off a cliff. And globally, the global GDP rate was expected to be 3.6, now 3.4. This is not enough to cause anything like what happened in 2008, 2009, when the global economy tanked in a very rapid fashion, or for those of you that remember 97, 98 with the Asian financial crisis, that started off as a single event in Thailand, which would probably have been no big deal until it started to morph to Indonesia, the Philippines, Brazil, Korea. I mean, it started going around the world. There's where the effects get much more pronounced, is if it is not isolated to Britain. If it doesn't stop in the UK and moves elsewhere, you can get an effect. One of the reasons why I am not that concerned about this is even if economic growth goes down in Europe, they have some of the lowest income and price elasticities in the world for food, which means even if they go into recession or we go into recession, our incomes are so high it will really not affect our demand for food. It'll affect our demand for BMWs, maybe iPhones and the like, but food is one of the most insensitive commodities out there. On the other hand, if what happens in Europe starts to morph through the developing world, through the emerging markets, you got to remember, Europe is a major destination for Chinese goods. I'm not talking about agriculture now. I'm talking about merchandise goods. That's how it's through the trade linkages that a European problem becomes a global problem. I just don't see that happening. What happens in a place like China, that will absolutely affect the global food system. So that should keep you awake at night, not what happened in Europe. How much time do we actually have? Plenty? All right. So same thing if it happens, if something happens from Europe and it finds its way into Latin America. For many of you, you know that one of our major grain competitors worldwide is Brazil and Argentina. All right. If something happens there that affects the currencies of these, it's already difficult to compete against South America right now. The currencies have realigned dramatically. USDA is already projecting the US dollar to climb over the next 10 years. That's already a headwind that's built into the cake prior to the Brexit vote. If the Brexit vote becomes something where it accelerates that growth curve for the dollar even more, that will be a problem. But in terms of the two events, currency realignment versus economic growth impacts, it is the demand side that is far more important than the realignment of the currency. I don't want to go too far here. I just want to leave you with one point, which is economists are famous for having on one hand this and on one hand that. It makes for a boring speech. I wanted to leave you with one very clear conclusion, and that is this event, as bad as it is and as scary as it is for the Europeans themselves, pose no real risk, in my opinion, for the global food system. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
The one thing I've learned over the years is that Mike is definitive, if not anything else. So thank you, Mike. So
occasionally wrong, never in doubt.
That's right. Well, I'd like to open up our Q&A portion, which to me is one of the more exciting parts of a session like this, because quite frankly, we get to hear from you all in the audience and get to have a very candid conversation with our panelists. So in light of that, I'd like to invite any of you in the room that would like to ask a question. We have a microphone set up here. Please go ahead and approach the microphone and identify yourself when you ask your question. For those of you who are on the audio cast, again, I'd like to remind you that you can submit questions, and we will share those, or staff will present those questions, and we'll include you in the conversation that way. So I'd like to actually go ahead and maybe perhaps kick off a question. I took copious notes during the presentations, but one of the ones that I wanted to touch on was one that Benno actually, you spoke to in more detail, I think, than the other two panelists, but interested in all three of your perspective on this. We've been working for quite some time to establish closer ties we in the United States with the EU regulators, from everything from regulatory enforcement to harmonization of standards and different criteria. So given the size and the importance of the UK market and the EU market, how do you think the split will affect those efforts? And what kind of complexity does it add? And I think I'm getting at a little bit more, Benno, when you were saying that the UK has been a bit of a leader in that conversation. Are there other countries that you see would be able to step up and provide a leadership role? And how do you think the split and the lack of UK leadership affect some of those ongoing negotiations? And I ask you to start, Benno, but then John and Mike, you can chime in there.
Constance, yeah. As I alluded to, the UK tends to take positions that are based on science, that are in favor of free market, and it's difficult to make generalizations on this, but that tends to be a group of countries that vote in that same way. They tend to be smaller countries like Denmark, Sweden, Finland, Netherlands, Belgium to some extent, Ireland to some extent. With the UK gone, hopefully they will carry the weight, but they will miss this large ally in those discussions. Germany is always been a difficult to gauge. It's of course the biggest country in the EU, is a leader in many areas of policy, but when it comes to regulation that affects food and feed and agriculture, Germany tends to be sitting on the fence on a lot of these issues, and that is because of their own domestic politics, where you have a coalition government that is made up of right-of-center Christian Democrats and left-of-center Social Democrats. And in their coalition agreement, they have specified how they will vote on some EU issues. And in many cases, that is to abstain. That reflects their own internal divisions. And that is the reason why Germany, in some of the issues that are of interest to US agriculture, is a tricky country to deal with.
Thank you. Mike or John?
Maybe just firstly, Constance, just to respond to Mike, I completely agree with him on the global context. Certainly for us in the US, for our business, really Brexit is not something that's a factor in our long-term thinking right now. On your question, we saw some of the qualified majority voting outlined there. I was on the standing committee in Brussels for 10 years, the standing committee food chain animal health, both on animal nutrition and on GMOs, and I can tell you that the UK always brought a sensible voice to those discussions. They'll still be there for the next 2 years. In terms of how that resonates in TTIP, or does it make a difference? Ultimately, the Commission are the negotiators, and they will carry out the mandate of 28 member states, which is not that easy. The UK do bring a pro-trade voice, though. They were an outward-looking thought leader on trade, and that would be a concern, I suppose.
We'll go to the floor for a question.
I'm Jerry Hagstrom from the Hagstrom Report. I walked in a little bit late, so if this question was addressed, please forgive me. But I wonder what's going to happen with the subsidies that the EU that the British farmers have been getting, and also the regulations from the EU to which EU farmers seem to have objected. I had this experience. I was in the UK doing interviews on TTIP last fall, and I had this British producer who is hoping to export bull semen to the United States say he thought he was going to vote against, he was going to vote for Brexit. And it did not seem to be an economic decision. It was just a completely emotional reaction that he did not like being dominated from Brussels. So I'm curious as to what's going to happen with this. And also, the EU has always been a critic of the big subsidies, but also a very strong opponent of restricting subsidies to big farms. So you're going to have some big EU operations that theoretically will lose their subsidies. Are they expecting that the British government is going to replace them, or what do you think is going to happen on this?
Like to start, John?
Yeah, I can kick that off, Jerry. We can only judge on what's been said in the campaigning. So the DEFRA Secretary Eustace was pro-leave, and in some of his remarks he said that the UK would fill the gap on direct payments, which I think is about 2 billion euros a year. There is a House of Commons library paper that says there is no way the UK can bridge that difference from what the EU currently pays. You're right that the UK have been very strong on budget, particularly on CAP, on due diligence and maybe more careful policing of the budget on CAP over the last reform sessions. But they have supported the second pillar, which is the environmental pillar. And I'm not sure how you fill that void without European support. The argument is that without the contribution to CAP, they can just keep that money. But there's, as I said in my remarks, there's going to be a lot of people looking for a lot of different supports.
Yeah,
Jerry, I would say if you're trying to minimize the impact on UK agriculture, you're going to want to mirror as close as you can cap policy. The issue, though, is that people forget that one of the things that holds European agriculture back are all these subsidies, which distort all kinds of decision-making when it comes to ag. People forget when countries like Australia moved away from subsidies, it really freed that sector up to become more globally competitive, more outward-looking. Australia relies heavily on the international market for its output. If Britain finds it's going to have to rely more and more on non-EU markets, non-UK markets for its output, it really shouldn't want to mirror common agricultural policy. It'll want to use that as an opportunity to move to a more market-oriented system. That's how they're going to survive the transition. At least that's my opinion.
Benno, anything to add?
Maybe on the last point, going back to what I've said before about new technologies and for example, in biotech, and this comes back to the question, what kind of deal is the UK going to have with the EU after the withdrawal process has been completed? Will it pursue its own legislation on issues like this? If it does, then maybe the UK will be in a position to be more open to using these new technologies in the future. But I think this is one of the questions that will remain open for some time to come.
Great, thank you. Looks like we have a question from the audio cast. Mary?
Yes, this question is from Jean Gorley at the Gorley Research Group. What is the impact of, what does Brexit mean, I haven't had enough coffee. What issues does Brexit pose to the Greeces or Spains of the EU that are in financial turmoil? Is this going to be worse for them, better, or no impact?
Well, maybe I'll take a shot. Maybe you can, too. My guess is over the next 6 months, the rest of Europe that's looking at these same issues is going to get an education. They're going to get a chance to see what happens to agriculture, what happens to all sectors of the UK economy. I mean, it's horrible, all of the uncertainty that's part of this process, and it's not going to be dealt with quickly. If it, in fact, it is terribly chaotic for the UK, that lesson will be felt by the Spanish and the Greeks and the like. And if Northern Europeans start following the UK example, they're the ones that provide a lot of the input to Brussels to distribute to the southern countries. The southern countries are largely takers of payments. They're net users of the payments supplied largely by the north, but there's a number of northern countries right now that are considering doing something similar to what Britain has done. So, I mean, I don't think anyone has the answer right now because it's just, 2 weeks later? There's not enough time. You don't really know what's going to happen. I just say it's a little too early to tell, but I'm sure they're going to watch closely over the next 6 months to a year.
Yeah, just to build on that, Mike. Indeed, the UK is a net contributor to the EU budget, so there'll have to be a renegotiation on those contributions. So countries like Spain, Portugal, and Greece will be concerned about that in terms of what they can get. When it comes to other countries potentially looking at something similar, like the Brexit referendum, there are parties in some countries where nationalistic groups are pushing for something similar. In some countries, they have quite a bit of support in the polls. But I think we'll have to wait and see how this pans out in the next year or so, when we look at the elections in France, for example, where Marine Le Pen has announced that she would like a referendum on France's membership. So a lot will hang on the outcome of the elections there, for example, whether she will have the platform to push for that. And something similar may happen in the Netherlands, where we have a nationalistic party that wants the Netherlands to leave. Although there was a vote in the Dutch parliament already about holding a referendum, and that was resoundingly defeated. So I'm not sure how concrete this concern really is, but France would be, the French election will be very important to watch.
A quick follow-up question to that, and based on what you all just shared, I'm kind of curious. I understand that Scotland has very quickly came out and indicated that their vote to separate from the UK went the way it did because it was assumed that that would allow them to remain in the EU. Given the Brexit vote and Scotland's indications that they may call for another vote on independence, what kind of warning shot is that for other countries that may be considering exiting the EU, who also may have regions within their own country that they would worry may make the same type of move? I'm thinking specifically of Spain and the Basque region and some other areas. Do you think that that's also something that's going to have a huge impact on how other EU member countries view this type of move?
Shall I have a go? I think there is concern in some countries that this will give some of the independent movements in their own countries hope. Spain, for example, although I don't think there is a great deal of anti-EU sentiment in Spain, I do not see that as a realistic scenario there, but Spain has indicated that if Scotland were to do a second referendum and were to vote to become independent of the UK, that it wouldn't automatically or easily become a new member of the EU in its own right. It would have to apply, and that will require a lengthy negotiation. And again, Spain has come out with these comments in order not to fuel the fire in Catalonia or the Basque Country.
Thank you. We have another question from the floor.
Chris Clayton, I'm an editor with DTN, the Progressive Farmer, and I need to be more parochial in my question. I guess I'd like to ask you guys, what do you see now as the future of TTIP? It seemed to, right after Brexit, the comments from about the French election, our own election issues. Does TTIP ever get done? Does it become another Doha where we continually try to resuscitate it and it goes on hiatus, it comes back? Or do we actually ever get a deal done?
Anybody?
I think we should digest some of these things and go to Las Vegas because we don't know. I mean, the message from the European negotiators is that they want to get something done this year. My interest is in US dairy mostly, where we're working on TPP on the Hill here. Even getting that done right now is difficult on this side of the water, so where does TPP fit in after that? I don't know.
Let me just add my two cents. I mean, one of the biggest sticking points in the TTIP negotiations is agriculture. Most people in agriculture weren't terribly optimistic that this thing would ever happen before the Brexit vote. Clearly, it's probably made that a more difficult situation, but these things never just decide to, everyone walks away and say, we're not going to negotiate anymore. I mean, they usually put these things like the Doha track, which is, what, 10 years now, maybe more than 10 years for all I know. That's a horrible comparison to make, but it may not be that far from true. I don't think either side wants to just give up and walk away. But clearly, this hasn't made the job of the negotiators any easier, that's for sure.
And let's not forget, the UK are still a member state. So, you know, if there's a negotiation round, it's business as usual right now.
Yeah, I think I agree with what you said, Mike. The European Commissioner for Trade has stated that the Brexit vote doesn't affect the European Commission's ambitions for TTIP, that they continue to push for these negotiations. What will happen in practice, we may have a better sense of that at the end of this week when the 14th round is completed.
Great, thank you. I do have one quick follow-up to that, and then we'll go to our audio cast question. Benny, you mentioned that the Canadian agreement was now being subject to individual member vote. Is that something that you think once that we learn more about this Brexit and what that means, and given the fact that the UK will still be a member for some period of time, that we may actually have things settled down to a point where the TTIP would not have to go through a similar individual vote by each country?
That is possible. I think every trade agreement stands by itself and has its own political ramifications and considerations. But if there is a TTIP deal that is in context and scope, content and scope similar to what CETA is, it will be very difficult for the European Commission to propose anything different for the ratification of TTIP further down the line.
Okay, thank you. Mary, our question from AudioCast?
Yes, from Bob Frazee at Mid-Atlantic Farm Credit. Given the economic interdependence that exists between the UK and other members of the EU, how likely is it that an exit will be negotiated that largely preserves the investment and trade flows between countries and companies?
I think, Benno, maybe you could take it on after this, but there are a number of different options if and when Article 50 is triggered. So Article 50 is the formal notification that the UK will leave. Prime Minister May, I assume she's Prime Minister by now, has said that that will not be triggered till probably the end of this year, early next year. If they trigger it, and they're looking at their options, they can follow what Norway has, which excludes agricultural products. So Norway does pay tariffs on agricultural products entering the EU. They can look at what Switzerland has, which is essentially an FTA with the European Union. They can look at something like a CETA model, the Canadian Free Trade Deal, or they can go to WTO tariffs. And just to give you a sense on WTO tariffs, car manufacturing is quite big in the UK. Tariffs on that would be about £1 billion a year, 10% tariff entering the EU. That's according to the UK Treasury paper on what Brexit would mean. So they're the options they have right now, but I think as each of us said in our presentation, one of the core freedoms of the EU is the movement of people. That excludes the Norway option. You have to accept the movement of people if you want to be part of the single market.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely all right, John, and I think everyone, both in the UK and in the EU, would like to preserve the existing interconnections to the extent possible. And it will be in the skill of the new UK government to negotiate something that is as close to that as possible, while also being able to sell politically the idea that the free movement of people is somehow restricted as part of that deal. That will be a tricky balance for everyone to find.
Okay. We have a question here on the floor.
I'm Ken Peoples from the Peoples Group. I believe very much in immediate markets, but also in longer-term markets. And the immediate markets, as Mr. Twarp works out, there were lots of volatility and fluctuations. But at the end of the day, they did tell us something. The pound went down by 15%. Wasn't that the quick back-of-the-envelope or black box calculation of how much the pound would have to be devalued to enter into the EU market with the same products? Probably. Why do I say that? Because what equity markets went down? Was it the UK? Not really, 3%. Germany, France, Italy, Spain all went down 2 to 3 times that. In the long term, this is a challenge to Britain, isn't it? I mean, to the EU, isn't it? You have GDP of 1.5% for the last 30, 40 years, it hasn't gone up much more than 2%. Basically, with all of the system that you've created, economic and social, you put it at a high price. High price relative to employment. And you've made it very expensive. People in the EU pay a great deal for food. Is not this vote, to a degree, not by the uneducated, as we might say, but by the people who have less income, disposable income? Those are the people that are voting with their pennies. And they voted in one direction, and they voted very heavily. Is that the same case in the EU that people are thinking about that? Is the decision-making group really going to look hard at that and say, is this the direction we want to continue to go, and is it going to keep it together? Because right now, small business in the European Union doesn't do very well. With all of the regulations and difficulties in dealing with almost the entire regime, you've got to be a big company. And so it's big companies and big government. That results in high employment, high unemployment, which has been the case for a long time. Is there going to be a serious relook at this, or is it going to be business as usual?
Thank you, Ken. Reactions from the panelists? Benno?
A first reaction maybe, and I think we have to analyze better what led to this vote, why it was held, and why the people voted the way they did. My sense is that a lot of that was around the whole immigration problem. So timing played a role in that. To your broader comment about, I suppose, big government and heavy regulation, I think you're right that the EU in some ways and in some areas has gone quite far in regulating economic activity. But when it comes to the way European countries have organized themselves in terms of their taxation and social security systems and healthcare systems, that was done by these countries themselves, because those are policy areas that do not fall within the jurisdiction of the EU. So whether countries are part of the EU or not, if they want to reform their own societies, they have to take those decisions by themselves. And of course, those are very tough decisions. And but I'm not sure that this is something the EU was responsible for by itself.
John or Mike, you want to add anything? Okay. Do we have any other questions from the audio cast, Marion? Okay, thank you. Anything from the floor? If not, I do have one other question I was going to ask. Okay, don't want to preempt that. One of the things that we also touched on, and it may have been mostly answered in the presentations, but one of the things that we on this side of the pond have observed is the change in CAP over the years from a as John, I think you pointed out, genesis in the lack of food product following major conflicts there, from one that went from intervention purchases and export subsidies to dispose of that to less market distorting direct payments, as you outlined. What do we think the loss of the UK will mean in how the CAP continues to go forward and is designed? Again, the UK was a major voice in the CAP design. And do we think that will have an impact on the trade flows between the United States and the European Union? I'll start. Mike, I'm going to actually, do you have a quick?
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
I guess to the extent, I think most of the impetus for CAP reform has been budget related. In other words, the reason they reformed it wasn't because they woke up and read, you know, John Keynes or something one day and decided to go more market oriented. It was largely because it was bankrupting the Commission. So to the extent that, that this furthers that reform and there's even less intervention in the market, that brings EU agriculture more in line with the rest of the world. That should actually incentivize more trade between blocks. But I'm not sure this event in and of itself is enough of a reason. It's a fairly bold step. Europe is a fairly, I won't use the word socialist, but it's far more interventionist than the U.S. economy is, not just in agriculture, but throughout. I don't know if this is enough to change their basic mindset, but certainly if there are some additional countries that want to bail, that might, but, you know, I don't really have anything more.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. John?
Yeah, I think... as a net contributor to the Common Ag Policy, the loss of the UK is a euro loss. We're currently in a cap cycle right now, which will be up for midterm review. So you extract out that net contribution, you're going to see a reduction in supports for producers, I would imagine. What the last cap reform did do was introduce more member state autonomy on some of the tools they can use, particularly on pillar two, which is the environmental pillar. So that would kind of mitigate against some of the impact. But directly for producers, as we continue to go through cap reform cycles, as we continue to be a global trading world, I think you're going to see a continued pressure on the budget at EU level.
Ben, anything to add on that? All right, thank you. Do we have any other questions from the audience? Oh, yes, Floyd, and then Jerry.
Yeah, Floyd Gabler, U.S. Grains Council. You know, it's clear to me that, you know, the Brexit folks had hardly any clue about what the impacts of this was going to happen, and it didn't help when the proponents of Brexit left, you know, and resigned and left the carnage for everybody else. And if you look at the options that I've seen described, you know, for the EU or for the UK, none of them look very good, you know, if they're going to address the reasons why they left. And I guess, you know, my view is it's not going to end well, short-term or long-term, for the UK or the EU. And so my question is that are people going to finally come to grips with this and realize that maybe this wasn't a good idea and maybe that Brexit needs to be reversed, particularly if Scotland decides to, you know, say, we don't like this idea. I know, Theresa May said Brexit is Brexit, but I don't see the economic answers there to make this thing work.
So I guess the question is, can they change their mind?
It's been done before. Ireland rejected Maastricht and Lisbon, as other member states had done, and revoted. It has happened before. Prime Minister May was electioneering at the time, saying Brexit is Brexit. I heard a poll yesterday that said 33% of respondents in the UK now say leave. So maybe the realization of what's happening might set fall, but right now we just don't know if there's going to be a relook at this or not. You've also got the dynamic of an opposition party in turmoil too, with Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the Labour Party. There was a motion of no confidence against him. Now that's a problem where you don't have a strong opposition. If the UK were to advance on an Article 50, the legal advice that I've seen so far says they do not need to run that through Parliament. That can be done at PM and Cabinet level. If it was to go to Parliament, the majority of parliamentarians are pro-Remain. So that gives you a mindset of how important it is that the opposition figure out where they want to go on this, never mind the new Conservative leadership.
Benno, anything?
Not really much to add to what John said. The referendum was not legally binding, but for the moment it doesn't seem to be a political excuse to go back with a second referendum. But that may change. This is politics.
Mike?
Okay, great. Yes, you had another question, Jerry?
Up to what we were talking about before. When you talk about Pillar 2 in the EU, it seems to me a lot of the impetus from that has come from the environmental movement rather than this being initiated by the farmers as something they really wanted. I think they would have preferred to keep their subsidies that are not necessarily production related, but not with all these regulations. So I'm wondering, in the UK now, if they're going to provide the money, you know, from the UK budget as opposed to from the EU budget, are they? Do you think they'll still try to maintain the countryside as we have been talking about, or you know, would it be different? I mean, I can see in the EU, certainly the urbanites would want the countryside maintained so when they drive through it, it's beautiful. Whether that's what the farmers want, I don't know.
Yeah,
John?
Really interesting one, Jerry, on your comment on the urbanites. We did some, in fact, I think, Dale, you were over the research funding at the time in Ireland when we looked at the impact of asking the consumer, are you happy to pay for that environmental pillar? And it was done through a series of photographs of the countryside. Would you pay for that? Would you pay tax dollars to make that difference? And the answer was yes. Thankfully, there wasn't a referendum and digging deeper on it. The environmental pillar, you're right, is something that comes at a cost, I suppose, to producers, but that is rewarded in what they get long-term from a sustainability point of view. For the UK to go down that route, it does carry a cost. It would be a decision that their taxpayers have to make. But certainly the experience of a country like Ireland or Denmark or whatever the serious agricultural producing countries are, you get a higher value product and a more long-term sustainable agriculture by investing in that pillar. I firmly believe in that. You also have the rural economy measure in that too, of keeping people in the countryside. And let's not forget that there are 28 very different member states. So a typical farm in Romania could have average acreage of 3 or 4 acres. You have a common ag policy that suits that kind of agriculture and a common ag policy that suits, shall we call it, sustainable intensification in some other more evolved member states. So you've got to find different tools to tailor how you're going to do that. One of the things I've seen mentioned is that the UK would return to a cheap food policy of the past. I would be hoping that the experience of the Common Ag Policy shows that you can climb the value, and listen, Glanbia are the living embodiment of this, you can climb the value-added ladder by paying for those extra goods, and ultimately investors want to see that you're paying for things like sustainability.
Thank you. We have another question from the floor.
Just one last one. The accent gives it away a little bit. John Wilkes, I'm a UK-US ag consultant. Just a very quick update, if I could, from the farmyard, as it were, a lot of my friends in the UK, so this is people of regular email contact with me. The sheer horror of what they've done is sinking in the UK agriculture industry. Last week, the major UK farming media was awash with worries on Brexit, the BBC Radio Farming Today show. So there's a lot of worry going on. And it quite simply has nothing to do with business. This is purely, I voted, and I voted to stay in very proudly. This has nothing to do with trade. It is purely immigration. That is what sunk us, I'm afraid. My question is, further down the line, there's going to be negotiations with the US, sort of so we can continue to trade. I just wondered if the US would see it to look on us favorably, to give us favorable trading terms in the sense that we could be a kind of a powerful leverage to help another version of TTIP. So my question is, would it be in the US interest to look after us, as it were? Thank you.
Very good question.
So, Benno, I'm going to ask you to take a first crack at that one, because it is an interesting question. I know that President Obama has already indicated that it would not take priority over TTIP negotiations, but that is an interesting question, and with the change in leadership here in the upcoming months, where do you think that falls?
I think to some extent that will depend on the type of relationship that the UK is going to be able to negotiate with the EU. If that future relationship still maintains the most basic principles of the internal market, I think that would be an important factor for the US if and when it starts talking about the trade relationship with the UK. So I think it may take some time for that to become clear, because the expectation is that the UK-EU negotiations for a future relationship will take quite some time.
Mike?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, all I can go by is what I hear almost every president say at least sometime during their term, which is we have a special relationship with the UK. I cannot believe for a minute that there won't be a US president, regardless if it's Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, that would not embrace the idea of an FTA with the UK. That's not going to replace, though, what's going to be lost with them leaving the EU. I mean, it's going to pale by comparison. But I doubt there'd be a lot of resistance here in the U.S. to a special an FTA with the UK. But I'm saying that as a private citizen. You know, I don't have any special insight there. But given how close we are on so many issues, it would just be hard to believe that we wouldn't pursue something like that.
John, and I'm going to put a little bit of a tweak on that question when I go to you, and any Benno or Mike, you could also come back in. But are there other parts of the economic sector other than just agriculture that may incent that to happen beyond just the agricultural interest in some sort of bilateral agreement? So you can respond to the first question, which you may have been thinking about, and then mine.
As I showed in the bigger picture information there, the UK is the number one foreign direct investment country into Europe, and that is because it is into Europe. Post Article 50 in negotiation, you shut down that avenue. I don't see why. What's the benefit of a free trade agreement? So if you're a US negotiator, you want to get the best possible economic win for the US. Do you pitch that against 5/6 of the EU economy or 1/6? The UK is 1/6 of the EU economy. So I think it all depends on if Article 50 is triggered, that UK-EU relationship is the key for the US. If you can maintain that flow and pretty much business as usual, then it may make sense. But right now, TTIP is the one under negotiation.
Very good. Thank you. Any other questions from AudioCast or from the folks here in the room? All right. With that, I'm going to ask everyone to help us thank our panelists. Thank you. Very much appreciate the engagement from both the folks on the audio cast who were able to join us. Again, thanks to Farm Credit helping us bring this discussion broadly beyond Washington. And for everyone who joined us here, Farm Foundation is pretty excited about the opportunity to bring these three together and talk about such a timely issue. So thank you all, and safe travels.